Okay, this is part two of the interview with Alan Reuther. This is Mike Smith interviewing Alan Reuther in the UAW Washington Legislative Offices on July 4th, 2010. So,
June 4th.
June 4th. I said July, sorry. Already it's off to a burning start. Okay, July 4th.
June 4th.
Jeez. I think we've, in the previous interview, have covered most of your background, your childhood, growing up a Reuther. There was one item you mentioned that you wished to address, and that was the internship with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights that you attended. Maybe you could mention a couple things about that.
In 1964, my dad moved our whole family to Washington, D.C. for the summer. And while we were here, I basically worked as a unpaid volunteer, an office boy for the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, and that was right in the midst of the campaign to pass the 64 Civil Rights Act. And so I guess that was really my first work experience in doing legislative work. And I just remember being thrilled at the time to, made me feel big and involved in all of that. But, and of course, my dad at the time was involved in lobbying for the civil rights legislation, and the enactment of that was actually one of the brightest spots in his life, and he actually got one of the pens that was involved in the signing of the law, and that's one of the prized possessions I've always kept in my office. So I sort of like to think of my work as dating back to 64.
Obviously left an impression on you. And it sounds like it's also sort of a chip off the old block. Your dad went to Brookwood, and this is sort of similar. Okay, well, the main theme for today's interview, of course, is your actual work for the UAW since 1983 when you moved to Washington. And then, of course, in 91 you became director here. And so I thought maybe we could start with an explanation of your philosophy on working with Congress. And in the type of work you do, the philosophy you take to your work. And my follow-up question will be on UAW positions and the underlying premise for UAW positions. So I say that because they might be one and the same or closely interrelated. But the main point is, what is your philosophy on working with Congress? What's carried you through?
Well, I've always been proud to represent the UAW's positions to Congress because I think our philosophy has always been it's not just about the interests of our members, but it's part of advocating more broadly for policies that we think benefit the entire public. I mean, healthcare is an example of that, but minimum wage would be another example. There's many aspects that are involved in the legislative work. I mean, sometimes it's preparing testimony that we deliver ourselves, or some of our experts from Detroit would come and deliver, but we'd prepare that. It's sending letters up to the Hill to indicate what the position of the union is on various issues. And then a lot of time meeting with either the members themselves or their staff to both to explain our positions, but also to urge the members to side with us. An awful lot of time is spent working with coalition partners, working with other unions, working with outside groups, depending what the issue is. It might be other organizations interested in civil rights, it might be groups interested in healthcare, whatever it is, but we've always found that there's strength in having a broad coalition, so as much as possible we try and work in a coalition. Sometimes we were with the auto companies, sometimes we had opposing views, so that was really a case-by-case situation. The other aspect is we've always found that our ability to be successful really depended on our ability to get grassroots pressure. Although I feel we were always pretty well respected on the Hill, ultimately the members of Congress care about getting reelected. And so if they were hearing from UAW members back home with calls or meetings or letters reinforcing our message, we would be successful often. But if we didn't generate that grassroots pressure, we're much less likely to be successful. So part of our job has always been working very closely with the CAP staff around the country, regional directors, to try and get that oomph from back home.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend on the Hill?
Oh, it'll vary, but I mean, there's times when we're up there nonstop, you know, entire working day, late into the evenings. I mean, there were times we did all-nighters when legislation was on the floor. There's other times when, especially over the years with email and all that coming in, you find sometimes it's easier to communicate with people through email now rather than trying to get them on the phone. So a lot of that can now be done from the office. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty on any bill, there's no substitute for either a face-to-face meeting or for a direct phone conversation with the members of Congress. I mean, just for example, the climax on health care reform this year, trying to round up with the votes in the House, I was making calls directly to members of Congress to have that direct conversation with them. So,
You've been doing it for quite a few years, and obviously emails and personal computers, I don't know if blogs or Twitter has made much of an impact, but what has changed in the way you do business over this time?
The grassroots component has totally changed. When I first came here, I remember the then legislative director, Dick Warden, when he wanted to send out a grassroots alert, he would write it, and then we basically had to get all of the clericals in the building to run off copies, to stuff envelopes, to mail it out. And there had to be enough lead time because people wouldn't get that mail for 3-4 days. Nowadays, I'll draft up what we call an e-wire, an electronic alert, bounce it off the folks in Detroit, get it approved in half an hour. Electronically, we send it out, and the whole thing's done in an hour. Mm-hmm. It's just an amazing difference. So, and it's, I hope in the future the union does even more in terms of beefing up our capacity to interact with our members electronically. I really think that's an important area that we can develop further.
Has Solidarity House moved in that direction?
We've been trying, but it's a whole process to make sure you get a e-wire system where you really identify the activists and who will sign up to get the alerts, and then making sure that people follow through.
We haven't talked about your specific work yet, so I may be putting the cart before the horse, but of course one of the issues you have to deal with is a changing changing nature of the Congress, the Senate and the House. As people move in, as Republicans or Democrats vie for control or gain control, and again, this might be putting a little bit of the cart before the horse, but who in Congress and in the Senate have you really liked working with, and who you think have been you've had a good relationship with?
Well, Obviously, the members of the Michigan congressional delegation have always been especially close to the UAW, and John Dingell, champion throughout his career on auto issues and many, many other issues. Representative Sander Levin, extremely important on the Ways and Means Committee, longtime friend of the UAW. In the Senate, Carl Levin for many years, and the importance of the Michigan delegation with the tremendous seniority and committee chairs and all of that has always been very helpful to the UAW. Over the years, we had a great relationship with Senator Ted Kennedy, and obviously he's a great champion on many, many issues. But the reach of the UAW, I mean, we had friends throughout the country, part of the job has always been, as new members are elected to Congress, getting to know the new members. At the very beginning of every Congress, we try and schedule courtesy calls with the new members, because they may know our people back in the states who help get them elected, but then we have to introduce ourselves here in the Washington office and then try and develop the relationship. And just one example, Representative Betty Sutton of Ohio, who's, I guess, now in her second term, and is clearly a rising star. And from the very beginning, after she was sworn in, it was apparent she was bright, aggressive, great on all the issues. And so, we moved quickly to introduce ourselves and then just to start working with her on a variety of issues. And this past year led to the enactment of the Cash for Clunkers legislation that she was the champion of. So you try and pretty quickly learn who are the members who are bright, have the respect of their colleagues, and therefore will be effective in getting things done, as opposed to those members who just like to issue press releases, but the follow-through isn't really there.
Mm-hmm. Of course, anyone who's read the papers over the last few years in Michigan knows that the UAW has lost a tremendous amount of membership. I assume this has affected your work. What would you have to say about that?
Well, absolutely. As plants have closed around the country, members who no longer have auto plants aren't as responsive anymore on auto issues. And it really just shows that members will respond if they have UAW members in their states or districts, because that's constituents who vote for them or against them. But once you lose that, in some cases they still will have a relationship with the member. They may still be interested in getting financial support, but it's not the same thing as having a plant that may have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people. As our numbers have shrunk, sure, our influence has been reduced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have a number of areas in which you've been responsible for as director. So I thought maybe we could run through a few of them, and please lead on. Because a lot of this overlaps, and you know the intricacies of it. But to start with, what about the CAFE laws and the UAW positions on those? Or please start where you think is appropriate.
Well, that's one area where there's been a very significant change in the last few years. If you go back historically, even dating back to when Dick Warden was heading up our office, the UAW generally joined with the auto companies in opposing legislation to increase the CAFE standards. Our position was not exactly the same as the auto companies. Companies tended to not want to see anything. In contrast, we said, we're for CAFE, we can support reasonable increases, but we never thought the actual proposals were reasonable. One of the most important reasons was, for many, many years, the proposals always were to have a flat MPG number, you know, increase the CAFE standard for all the companies to X MPG. And we always thought that type of proposal discriminated against the big three because they were full-line manufacturers producing lots of trucks, and unlike Honda or some of the others that were more focused on the smaller end of the market. So because we never thought the proposals were actually fair, we wound up working with the companies to oppose them, and for many years we were quite successful. In 2007, there was a significant change politically, and the proponents of having higher fuel economy standards were basically successful in getting legislation that led to the 2007 energy law. I think there was a number of factors. Partly was what you mentioned before, the reduced numbers of our members, and I think that meant reduced clout for us and the auto companies. Nancy Pelosi being Speaker of the House, and she from California, she was a strong proponent of tough fuel economy standards. But even more important than all of that, there was a whole group of people that we sort of referred to as energy security hawks, who really became convinced that it was in our national security interest to have higher fuel economy standards so it would be less dependent on oil from the Middle East. And just to use one example of a member who was influenced by that, Senator Barbara Mikulski, great longtime friend of the UAW. She had been with us in previous years in opposing higher fuel economy standards. I remember her saying that she told her environmental friends that she was green, but she was industrial green. But she changed in 2007, and it was because of the concerns about energy security.
Of course, this is in the midst of all the turmoil in the Middle East where the oil comes from.
Right. So the impetus was there, the votes were there to have higher fuel economy standards. But the other equally important thing that happened in 2007 is the structure of the CAFE standard was changed. And the people who were pushing higher standards recognized that it was important to modify the law so it wasn't a flat MPG standard for all companies. Instead, it would basically reflect the product mix of each company. And that made the standard much fairer. We no longer could say, oh, it's an unfair structure. And also in the final law that was passed, we were able to get our anti-backsliding protection included, which was designed to protect small car production in the United States. So the final law that emerged in 2007 had higher standards, but it also basically eliminated a lot of the structural problems that we had always had with CAFE. It was now fair to all companies, protected small car production, it recognized the difference between cars and trucks. And I think what that really did is that changed the whole debate going forward. And we don't have to argue about those issues anymore. The new structure also made it impossible for the companies to game the differences between cars and trucks. There's complicated reasons why that's the case, and historically the companies that try to make some of their cars be classified as trucks and vice versa to game the standards. The new structure, you can't do that anymore. All of that's good. So because of all that, the Obama administration came in, and we were suddenly faced with the new debate of, okay, California, others wanted a more stringent standard even than what was passed in 2007, and yeah, the companies wanted something not quite so stringent. But we didn't have all these other disputes over the structure. And our emphasis sort of shifted to, well, okay, we understand all these environmental reasons and energy security reasons for higher standards. Give us the resources to help the companies meet those standards and link it to domestic production of the vehicles. And so our focus really shifted it. The other thing that was included in the 2007 energy legislation was the Section 136 program to provide funds for encouraging companies to invest in domestic production of the advanced technology vehicles, the hybrids, plug-ins, et cetera. And really, ever since then, most of our focus has been trying to get funding for that program, trying to make sure that any climate change legislation continues that forward and provides funds for it. I'm sure going forward there will continue to be the pushing and tugging between the environmental groups in California and the companies over, you know, how fast can we move forward. But it's clear the trend is going to be moving forward. And I think the union's focus going forward will be, okay, let's let the experts decide how much and how quickly they can actually move forward technologically. But our focus will continue to be, let's make sure that these new vehicles of the future are built here. And that enables us politically to actually have a coalition with the environmental groups. And I think that's great politics. I think it's great on the substance.
Mm-hmm. And there's, you remind me of a national position that's out there, that the Detroit, the big three, have sandbagged on technology for years and years, and that they it wasn't so much that they couldn't develop the technology or did not have it, they're just reluctant because they were making more money off SUVs. The other side of the coin is it takes a long time to develop adequate technology. I wonder if you have some feelings on that.
Well, there's no question the companies wanted to make whatever was making them the most money, and for a period of time they were making huge profits over the pickups and the SUVs. And I guess I would say, in defense of the companies, no one held a gun at the head of consumers to buy those vehicles. Gas was cheap, credit was easy, and people were going and saying, yeah, I want those bigger vehicles. At the end of the day, the companies will produce whatever the customers, want to buy. But there's the larger social interests of what do we need to do on climate change, what do we need to do in terms of energy security. And that's why the UAW has always said, we support CAFE, let's find a reasonable path going forward. And that will require the companies to change the vehicles they make. I mean, I think it's very clear the future going forward is electrification of vehicles, and that's a profound change. But it doesn't have to be bad for the industry. Very recently, the UAW teamed up with the National Resources Defense Council and the Center for American Progress to do a study that basically said higher fuel economy standards can actually create jobs, because all these new components that you have to put in the vehicles, the hybrid systems, for example, takes a lot of labor to produce those. But, of course, the issue for us is, are those jobs going to be here in America or overseas? And mm-hmm. That's why we want the targeted government assistance tied to making the stuff in this country.
Mm-hmm. Coming from Michigan, of course, we watch this legislation very closely, at least a number of us do. And one of the encouraging programs recently is some of the high tech business that's gone to Michigan in terms of batteries, to say nothing of some of the wind energy and other things. But strictly speaking on cars, you know, I know at Wayne State we're working on hydrogen technology and nanotechnology, and but there's been some encouraging movement there. I wondered if you were involved with that at all.
Well, that's part of our whole effort in the energy bills to make sure that there's the funding to help produce the advanced vehicles. I mean, some of it goes into R&D, but we're also very interested in the actual production of these things. And we've been pushing the Obama administration now to, in deciding who they're going to give grants to pay attention to auto communities where there have been closed facilities. And we think it makes a lot of sense to try and direct the new investment into those communities that have been hit hard, maybe have plants that are sitting idled, and try and get companies to start back up. The whole situation with Fisker taking over the GM plant in Delaware is a good example. And now more recently, even with Tesla agreeing to reopen the NUMMI facility. And we think that type of approach really makes a lot of sense. So we're hoping to have even more of that going forward.
Do you have any predictions on the future regarding this?
Well, I guess I'm optimistic. I think eventually our nation will have to go forward with climate change legislation, and I think that's going to spur investment in a variety of areas, and I think we're going to be successful in getting an auto component to that. So the electrification of vehicles is going to come. I think we can do it the right way so that we actually stimulate auto jobs in this country.
Mm-hmm. Has the Obama administration been receptive to the
UAW?
On this issue, I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, they've been a supporter of the Section 136 program. They've been supportive of our efforts to get, in effect, a continuation of that program as part of any climate change legislation. We've been pleased with the position of the administration on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything else we should wrap up on that part of your work?
We've pretty much
covered it. Okay. I mean, it is important work. And I know we had the 2009 with the uniform federal standards. Things have changed a bit there. Well, one of the things you've worked with quite a bit is trade. And of course, one of the contentious issues, still contentious, depending on who you speak to, was the NAFTA. Passed or signed in 1992, as I understand it, and then ratified in 1994 and went into effect. So, were you involved with the NAFTA struggle?
Yes, very much. The NAFTA struggle really had two phases. The first phase was they had to pass fast-track authority to consider that. And many people in the labor movement and our allies realized that fast-track was crucial to passing any type of trade deal. That once fast-track is in place, it's very difficult to stop any trade deal because it's just an up or down vote. And you can't have any amendments and limited time period, no filibuster. So we and other unions mounted a major effort to try and stop fast track. And my memory is that actually happened under the first President Bush. But I remember going with UAW President Owen Bieber to meet one-on-one with the Democratic leader in the House, Dick Gephardt, to try and get him to come out against fast track. And other union presidents had lobbied him too, and he basically refused to do that. At the time, he had a rationale that, even if there's fast track, the House under its rules can still decide not to go forward. And that's the line he used. And really, his decision to back fast track made the difference in fast track being approved. Well, our fears turned out to be correct then when President Clinton came in and he backed NAFTA, and because it was subject to fast track, the odds were stacked against us. And then we did this all-out campaign against it, along with the rest of the labor movement. I remember one of the things at the end that swung the balance in favor of the president was they convinced Representative Esteban Torres to back the deal. Part of it was having these side agreements on workers' rights. I think there was also this, I think the term was NAD bank, but it was supposed to be a bank to provide development funds along the border areas. This was a real blow to the UAW because Esteban Torres had been a former UAW staff member, a close ally. I think really what was going on, though, also was in the Hispanic communities in Texas, California, et cetera, there were mixed feelings about the NAFTA agreement. And so I think Representative Torres and other Hispanic members were feeling cross pressures, and I think that influenced them. Anyways, we lost the vote. I remember during the debate, we said there's going to be all these terrible consequences in autos. The other side said, oh no, it'll be great for autos because Mexico has all these barriers to U.S. autos and the U.S. market's already open, so we're just going to get rid of the Mexican barriers and that'll be great for us. And we said, that's crazy. This will be a green light for companies to shift production to Mexico. And of course, our fears turned out to be absolutely correct. There's been a huge movement of auto production, not only by the big three, but by foreign companies to set up shops in Mexico. And that same debate has always been repeated in subsequent debates over like China PNTR, other trade deals. It's the argument from the free traders is always, oh, the other markets are closed and we're getting rid of their barriers, it'll be great for us. And we always say, no, this is about where the companies are going to locate the work and we'll get the short end of the stick. Our fears turned out to be correct. The side agreements on worker rights proved meaningless. Our auto trade deficit with Mexico skyrocketed as more and more plants were set up there. I think the NAD bank turned out to be not what was promised. One of the disheartening things to me, right after we lost the vote on NAFTA within the labor movement, there was UAW and the other unions that had been deeply involved wanted to say, okay, this was a litmus test vote, or the labor movement should not support anyone who was wrong. And I learned my first lesson sitting around the table looking at the affiliates. A lot of affiliates who had, said, oh yeah, we're with you, we oppose NAFTA, came time to want to hold members accountable. They said, well, no, we won't go along with that because we have our own parochial interests. The letter carriers had their postal issues, the building trades had their issues, and it really drove home to me that how diverse the labor movement is, and something that would be a do-or-die issue, let's say, to industrial unions, is not a do-or-die issue to other parts of the labor movement. So the labor movement was not effective in holding members accountable on NAFTA. And that same thing has been repeated on a whole range of other issues. It's individual unions may decide that they're going to use a particular issue as a litmus test, but the labor movement as a whole finds it very difficult to do that.
Do you think if the vote were today that you'd have a stronger coalition? I mean, you know, if it was, I'm not, you know, 16 years of hindsight, of course, you know, one can predict a lot of things, but under the same circumstances, and not having it in place for 16 years, but if the vote today, do you think labor unions would coalesce better than they have, or is this just a...
I think the dynamic of the labor movement would be the same. Mm-hmm. And once an administration decides to go forward with any trade deal and it's under fast track, looking back over the years, I've realized it's very, very difficult to stop a trade deal. Mm-hmm. In fact, that we've never stopped any trade deal ever. Now, the Korea deal, they haven't moved forward with yet, and then because of the opposition we've generated.
Mm-hmm.
But any administration has so many tools they can use to influence members, and there's always a group of members that basically will bargain with the administration. Well, if you give me such and such on some other issue, I'll give you my vote on trade. I remember talking with a congressman from Texas on one of the trade bills, and he basically said, my district is very poor, and if I can get commitment on funds on this or that, I'm doing what's good for my district. And he didn't really care about the larger trade issue or what it might mean for auto jobs. He didn't have any auto jobs in his district. So,
what do you think the impact has been 16 years later on the UAW?
It's been terrible, and we've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. And mm-hmm. Other unions, the same thing. There's been a major movement not only of auto manufacturing, but manufacturing generally to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Korean, and then, of course, China. Maybe since you brought up Korea, you could discuss a bit what's going on with that.
Well, the Bush administration, second Bush administration, negotiated a free trade deal with Korea, and they basically traded away the auto sector to get things in the financial and insurance sectors. And this one, the UAW and some of the auto companies have actually worked together to oppose the Korean trade deal. Our complaint is it allows Korea to keep their market virtually closed to U.S.-built vehicles, and then we wind up just giving the Koreans even more access to our market. The independent studies by the International Trade Commission and otherwise indicate that bear out our concerns. They indicate that the Korea trade deal would make our auto deficit with Korea even worse by about $1 billion. So we just see it as a further threat to auto jobs here, and that's why we've been opposing it, partly because of our efforts, partly because of problems in other parts of the agreement. Bush wasn't able to move forward with it, and then with the change in administration, fortunately President Obama has indicated that some of the provisions need to be addressed, that it's not acceptable as it is now. Including on the auto provisions. So far, there's not been any meaningful effort by the Koreans to sit down and renegotiate. So it's an issue that's still in play, but we continue to monitor it very closely. Our fear would be that they just make some minor tweaks that don't really change it, and then they come forward under fast track. Again, we have the same dynamic. It becomes very difficult to stop.
Now, as a layperson, it seems to me that during the discussions on NAFTA in the early 90s, that there were greater unknowns on how this would affect trade. And some folks might make a reasonable argument, but again, because of unknown. It seems with Korea, when you read Auto News, which may be a biased paper, but you read the normal media, The Economist or anything, they always point out that Korea has this extremely closed market. And there were a brouhaha a few months ago about this. But yet the free traders, as you say, in Congress just philosophically don't care about that kind of a thing. I mean, I have a hard time as a layperson grasping why anyone wouldn't see the barriers Koreans have put up, especially after the example of Japan, which may not be quite as strict, but it's still the same.
Part of it is the philosophical orientation of some members to be for free trade. But I think the larger issue is that any trade deal covers a wide range of issues. And for some sectors, some industries, the Korea deal is a good deal. In fact, the proponents of the deal will argue, and this is accurate, that if you look at our overall economy, it's beneficial to the U.S. And you go to specific members, they might say, for example, someone who represents a district where there's a lot of cattle, they might say, well, we're going to sell a lot more beef to Korea. Or, you know, rice farmers, you know, will export rice, or districts that have a lot of insurance or financial that say, hey, this is a good deal for us. Our firms are going to get more business. And so it goes back to what I was saying as well. They may not be that concerned about this is bad for the auto sector.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize that any trade deal, there's a balancing of different interests. I mean, you're not going to have a trade agreement where the U.S. Wins every single thing. There's always a trade-offs. But we just think they did a lousy job on autos. We're out there saying, hey, we want a better deal on this sector. It's not fair what the current conditions are. So, but that's where the difficulty comes in lobbying the issue.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand sometimes sort of the anti-auto philosophy in the country. I mean, certainly with the financial crisis we had in 2008 and 2009, there were plenty of people around the country that could give a damn about the auto industry, yet the two biggest industries in the world, or most glamorous or most influential, appear to me to be computers or related paraphernalia and hardware and software, for lack of a better term, and automobiles, you know. And yet there's this kind of general philosophy, it seems, that you have to fight. Am I describing that?
I think animosity towards autos increased since the bailouts, but even people who don't have animosity towards the auto industry, you'll have a large group of members who just say, I hear what you're saying, that it may be bad for you, but for my district or my state, it's positive. And I'm hearing from constituents who say this means jobs for our state, so I'm going to vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group of members who don't care that much either way, but maybe trade their votes for some other benefit that the administration might promise them on this or that. So, and again, going back to what was raised before with the smaller numbers, smaller number of plants around the country, there's not as many places that have a direct stake in the auto issue, so that's made a difference too.
And you mentioned China. That's another issue that you're working on. Perhaps you could give us the general parameters of your work and position on that.
Well, the big fight was over granting China permanent normal trade relations. For a long time, it was sort of every year they had to renew it. There was a big fight. And then I believe it was the first President Bush who negotiated the deal with, maybe it was President Clinton. I'm fuzzy on the years. But anyways, it was the deal on China being allowed into the WTO and permanent normal trade relations. And I think a lot of members thought it was a step that needed to be taken because of the importance of China in geopolitical terms. But once again, we said this is going to be terrible for manufacturing. And we ran into the same argument of free traders saying, oh, this will be getting rid of China.
Chinese barriers, and our market's already open, so this will be positive. And we said, no, once you have permanent normal trade relations with China, that's a green light to companies that they can get even lower wages than Mexican wages by shifting production to China. And once again, we've proved to be correct. That's what's happened. The auto trade deficit with China has been steadily growing. The overall trade deficit with China is mushroomed. It's enormous. And there's no meaningful worker rights or human rights protections in China. So, you know, we think all our fears have been borne out. One of the most painful things about the whole debate over China PNTR was at the time Representative Sander Levin decided to back the deal, and that was very influential in providing the votes to get it passed. And that really hurt, having one of our staunchest allies, again from Michigan, giving a green light to that. The one other trade battle that I remember, there was a time when the Clinton administration pushed to renew fast-track legislation. And we in the broad coalition opposed that, again, because we realized fast-track is what greased the skids for more trade deals. And that's the only time we ever won a trade battle. We were able to ultimately stop the Clinton administration from getting the votes to pass the fast-track renewal. I'm proud of the great lobbying coalition effort we did, but I realize in retrospect the reason we were successful is Newt Gingrich was sitting there, and he didn't want it to pass because he, you know, this is one of his ways of attacking the Democrats. And what was happening is every time the administration would twist arms and pick up some Democratic votes, Gingrich would just peel away some Republicans. And I think at the time we had 60 or 70 Republicans who were prepared to vote against fast track. And I think that at the end, the Clinton vote counters realized that they'd never be able to get 218 votes, because no matter what they did on the Democratic side, Gingrich was just going to make sure. And on none of the other trade votes ever have we ever had that many Republicans be with us. So years later, I realized that it wasn't just our efforts that led to the victory. The other story in connection with that I remember, the story that I often recount when I'm speaking to UAW groups to illustrate how important grassroots communications are, there was a time when the fast track was being considered in the House Ways and Means Committee, and it was going to be very important how many Democrats we could get to oppose it. And there was a number of ones who were undecided, including a congresswoman named Karen Thurman from Florida. And I've been in to see her and talked to her a number of times, and she was still on the fence. And the day of the markup in the Ways and Means Committee, I decided to take one last effort, and I called up her office and asked to speak to her. Chief of Staff came on the line and said, "I'm sorry, that congresswoman can't talk to you now. She's on the other line with President Clinton." And my heart sank, thinking, you know, we're done for. I can't compete with that. And then the chief of staff or the congresswoman said, "Don't worry, your retirees have had our phone lines lit up all morning." And at the end of the day, she voted with us. So, and, you know, that was all because of the grassroots pressure. Uh-huh. And I'm sure, now knowing that, she was on the line saying to President Clinton, "I'm sorry, I can't be with you because I got to go with my constituents on this." So.
This is tangential, but I have a question. When you call up, do most congressmen and senators, will they speak with you?
It varies. Depends the nature of the issue. A lot of times they'll have a staffer call back. Or sometimes, you know, if it's a real important issue, like on healthcare reform, what often happened is the the staff would say, okay, we'll arrange a time when the congressman will call you back. Mm-hmm. Congressmen are running around, have so many meetings, it's often difficult to get right through, but oftentimes it's okay at such and such a time that we arrange.
They will give you access.
So, and a lot, again, will depend on is there a personal relationship. The last thing on trade is under Speaker Pelosi, there came a time towards the end of the Bush administration that Bush administration basically tried to ram an extension of the fast track through. And, it wasn't fast track. I think it was one of the smaller trade deals. And Speaker Pelosi basically said, well, I decide what the rules of the House are on any piece, and structured a rule that basically negated the fast track authority for consideration of the trade deal and stopped it from going through. And the only reason I bring this up is that it's exactly what Dick Gephardt had said he could do to stop NAFTA, even if there was fast track, but he didn't do it when NAFTA came up.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, Speaker Pelosi did use that authority to stop one of the trade deals that the mm-hmm. Bush administration was trying to push. So I've always sort of wondered, well, if Speaker Pelosi could do it, why couldn't Dick Gephardt do it? And interesting historical question.
Yeah, one might never know. But Dick Gephardt was also considered a friend to the UAW, as I recall.
He was a great friend, but I think he had actually mixed feelings on the trade issues. I mean, he was thought of in many quarters as a big opponent of trade and on labor side, mm-hmm. but I think he always had his eye on running for president, and so I think that made him not want to be known as the person who killed NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess what I'm suggesting is he may have pulled his punches a bit
mm-hmm.
and tried to have it both ways.
Politicians do that, do they? Yeah,
occasionally.
One of the other topics here, we've talked about trade a bit, is campaign finance reform. This has been going on in this country since, according to the sources that I've read, since about 1867, when the first financial reform package went to Congress, as meager as it was at that time. And of course, finances and campaigns have been an issue since this country was founded. So I know you've worked on that some. And then, of course, in we've had this big legislation in 2010. So I wonder if you would address some of your work in campaign finance reform.
Well, over the years, even before coming to the Washington office, I've been involved in the area. One of my jobs as a lawyer back in Detroit when I started with UAW was to be sort of the expert on campaign finance laws and to advise our CAP reps around the country. But then since coming here to the Washington office, I've been involved in the various battles over the year for a reform of the campaign finance laws. The UAW has traditionally supported public financing of both presidential elections and congressional ones, efforts to try and limit contributions by wealthy individuals, more disclosure. We supported the McCain-Feingold legislation. And the specific issue you mentioned relating to the Citizens United Supreme Court decision.
Right.
There's actually a long history on that that involves me personally. When I was a young lawyer in the UAW legal department just starting out, a think it was in 1978, there was, at that time, the Supreme Court issued a decision in the Bilotti case, which basically, to the surprise of a lot of people, said the states cannot prohibit corporations from spending their treasury money on ballot issues. And the rationale of the court for that was there's no danger of corruption. There's not a candidate there. So there's no reason to prohibit it. At that time in the legal department, we sort of prided ourselves on trying to look to test cases or some cutting-edge legal theories. And so my area, one of my areas, was campaign finance. So this really sparked my interest, and I did this whole analysis of, well, if the courts now said that you can't stop corporations from spending on ballot issues because there's no danger of corruption, the same theory should apply to independent expenditures, because if they're truly independent from the candidates, there can't be any corruption. And so I propose that the UAW should bring a test case to establish the right of unions to spend their treasury funds on independent expenditure campaigns in support of or opposing mm-hmm. candidates. And I did up this whole analysis, and together with the UAW General Counsel, we flew to Washington to meet with the AFL-CIO General Counsel to run through our analysis. And the AFL-CIO General Counsel, who was named Larry Gold at the time, said, well, your analysis is pretty good. The court might rule in your favor, but if they ruled in favor of unions doing this, they would say corporations could also do it, and corporations have infinitely more treasury money than unions, and so politically this wouldn't be good for us. And I and the UAW General Counsel said, oh, we hadn't thought of that. You're right. I guess maybe this is not a good test case to bring, and so we shelved the idea. Fast forward to now, the Citizens United case, all these years later, and in effect, the Supreme Court came down for corporations in exactly the same theory I had posited back in 1978, that, you know, independent expenditures, no danger of corruption, corporations can spend their treasury money. Ironically, one of the things that's changed, the AFL-CIO filed an amicus brief in the Citizens United case, arguing that unions should not be prohibited from using their treasury money for independent expenditure campaigns. And you'd ask, why would they do that? And what's changed over the years is the change in the labor movement and the rise of the public sector unions, and at least some of the public sector unions think that, well, whatever happens in the private sector, maybe in the public sector, it's to their advantage to be able to have the flexibility to use the treasury money. And so you have sort of a difference of opinion within the labor movement, even on this question. Now, I'm hopeful, despite those differences on the law, that the labor movement will in the end be united in supporting this legislation that's now moving to try and counteract the Citizens United decision by requiring tougher disclosure and a number of other reforms. But do feel like it's sort of ironic that after all these years, unfortunately, the Supreme Court picked up on the theory that I had thought about many years ago.
You were ahead of your time.
Unfortunately.
What impact do you think it's actually going to have?
Oh, I'm very worried that corporations will funnel millions and millions of dollars to front groups that will engage in all sorts of media campaigns, bashing candidates mm-hmm. That are more progressive, and I think it can have a horrible impact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was another thing that I noticed, and I don't know if it had much of an impact, but this Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2001.
That's the McCain-Feingold.
Right, yeah. Right. Is that had, were you involved in that?
We did support it, one of, I think, a few unions that did. Again, it's part of the tension, especially with some of the public sector unions. We thought, again, it was more important to have the limits